All right, it is good to see you all. It's good to sing with you all. It's good to study the scriptures with you all. This is a time, especially not only just today, but in everything that's going on, that it's especially important to do that and to be with each other, talk to each other, and especially go to God's word together with each other. And so I'm glad to be able to see you all, you know, as much percentages of our faces as that might be. But we're going to go ahead and we finished our series last week on reconciliation. And if you want to or get a chance to, we've got the recordings for that online for the past several weeks, and I hope that that's helpful and useful and true. I'm also hopeful that, you know, if you got any questions ever about any of those things, that you can feel free to come talk, either myself or the elders, and you know, we can work through those things. If you've got questions or some thoughts or some tweaks or different things like that, that we can communicate. The sermon is not the end of the idea; it continues on. We keep thinking about those things and seeing about how to live those. I don't present them perfectly. I don't have perfect knowledge, and so hopefully we're doing the best to communicate God's word, but if not, we're able to talk through those things, and so that's another blessing that we have, being able to share with each other. So because of that, since our series is done, we're going to go to a totally unrelated lesson, and this is going to come from Luke chapter 7, and especially verses 18 through 35, and I forgot here, I got my tape down, so let me move that. There we go. Okay, so Luke chapter 7 and verse 18. I've been talking with some of you a while back, like really at the start of everything, that I'd started a garden, really in March. It was like that first week that we went to the grocery store and there were huge lines outside and there were no veggies at all. And I thought, okay, well, I better start planning ahead if I want to eat some veggies. Who knows how long that's going to be? And, you know, there's that proverb that if you want a shade tree, the best time to plant that is 30 years ago. And so I figured, well, it's too late anyway. I may as well start now. So I built a garden. I built some little planter boxes that are out beside our house, just a couple feet by a couple feet, and planted a whole bunch of stuff. Deacon came out and helped me, and we planted some squashes, some zucchini. We planted some cilantro and some Brussels sprouts, and what else? I think there's something else, but that's about the gist of it. And so we were out there watering it and taking care of it, and then some things started coming up, and I was a little bit nervous because I'm trying to learn a lot. I knew almost zero. I knew that you need water and you need sun. And hey, Roy, let's head back to mommy, okay? There you go. So I knew almost nothing. You need water and you need sun. And in my reading, just trying to collect as much information as I could, I'd read about, you know, the dangerous impact that weeds have. But you know this. You've read the scriptures and you know how weeds are not good for your crop. And so I was looking out there and I started wondering, you know, this fresh dirt came out of a bag. But I know there's seeds blowing around all over the place, and so I have no real reason to believe that this thing is something that I planted or is a seed that landed in here and started planting some other weed. And so I get down there, like, at dirt level, and I'm trying to figure out what this is, and I mean, I don't know, it all looks the same. It's just, like, a couple of green sprouts that come out of the ground. And so I don't know if I need to pull this thing out or if it's actually something I planted and then I'm going to, you know, be working with for several months. And so I'm looking up online, I can't figure out anything, and I figure, well, I'll just let it go for a little bit and see what it does. Really, the only ultimate test of what a plant is what fruit it bears. Now, if you've been doing this for a while, which is not me, you know what seedlings look like from various different things, and the plant itself is its own form of a fruit from the seed itself. I didn't know any of that, and so I really needed to wait until things started to grow and to develop, and I'm comparing to other weeds around my house. But really, the lesson here is that the ultimate way that you determine what a plant is by the fruit that it produces. But you know that. You've read the scriptures. And in fact, if you've never been out and, you know, worked with a hose and a trowel before, you know so much about agriculture from the scriptures if you've spent any amount of time in them. Jesus brings up an interesting point here in the passage that Jason read for us a moment ago in a conversation that he's having with a few of his followers at this point. And that conversation really starts back in chapter 7 and verse 18. And what Jesus is going to show us here by the time that we get to the end of this passage is that the fruit tells the tale. The fruit shows, the fruit proves what the plant is, you know, what its metal is, you could say. And so even if you don't know anything about what else is going on, fruit becomes this great analogy. A crop becomes this great analogy to gauge the work of the plant. Now, here in this passage, we're going to get to see is a description of a concept that's been, I don't know if this is a real word, my spell check is saying it's not, but I think it works. Wisdom here, or a concept we could say, is going to be phytomorphize. So phyto is pertaining to plants, and morphize is like changing the plants. And so, you know, we think about things like that. People throughout the scripture are phytomorphized often. We're talking about people bearing fruit, being vines. That's a phytomorphization of that. Again, that's probably a fake word too, but there you go. We talk about sometimes anthropomizing or anthropomorphizing things, where we take something that's not a human and we give it human features or talk about it like it is a human. And so if any of you have dogs or cats, and you might, you know, say like, hey, my dog's saying, hey, why are you letting me out of the house or whatever, things like that. We anthropomorphize our animals to try and make some different point. And so here in this passage, you're going to see a concept be both phytomorphized and anthropomorphized, being given human traits and plant traits to teach us something important about the concept of wisdom. And so here, as we discuss wisdom this morning, in fact, our title today is Wisdom's Children, as it becomes anthropomorphized. We're going to learn a bit about wisdom and what it produces and how wisdom looks in our lives. There we go, I got to work. How wisdom looks in our lives based off of the fruit that it produces. Now, when we talk about fruit and turning things into humans, or talking about things like humans, talking about things like plants, humans produce fruit too. It's their children. Plants produce fruit. It's the fruit or the veggies, whatever. It's all fruit in this sort of analogy. And so you here are the fruit of your parents. In one way or another, you might look like them, you might not, know who they are, you might have been adopted by other families, it doesn't really matter, you are still the offspring of the plant that is your parents. Just like the fruit or the veggies that you might have at the dinner table is the offspring of something that came before it. And so what we're going to see here in our lesson today is wisdom described as a person, like a mother, and like a plant, something that bears fruit, to teach us if we have wisdom in our lives. That's the point of our lesson today. Do we have wisdom? Well, Jesus will say here that wisdom is vindicated by her children. Or in other words, you'll see wisdom in your life based off of the fruit that you produce. So let's go ahead and read through this passage to get some background here. All the way back to Luke chapter 7, verse 18, it says that the disciples of John reported to him all these things. John the Immerser, John the Baptist, he's been in prison by the local authorities. In verse 19, John, summoning two of his disciples, sent them to the Lord, saying, "Are you the expected one, or do we look for someone else?" When the men came to him, they said, "John the Baptist has sent us to you to ask, 'Are you the expected one, or do we look for someone else?'" And says, at that very time, you might have a footnote that says, at that very hour, he cured many people of diseases and afflictions and evil spirits, and he gave sight to many who were blind. And he answered and said to them, "Go and report to John what you have seen and heard. The blind receive sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised up, the poor have the gospel preached to them. Blessed is he who does not take offense at me." You know, when you read through these couple of passages, there's some funny things here that just like crack me up from a reading standpoint, but some very powerful things that are happening as well. One is that most of the time in the Gospels, Jesus will not often say what he's really doing or what he's really teaching or who he really is to almost anybody except for his very close group of disciples. What he does is he'll do something, and then he'll let you, the audience, make your own decision. It's kind of interesting. He's not going to force you in anything. He's not going to tell you, you know, what you should think. He just gives you an option, and then you've got to come to the truth on your own. And as John is expressing doubts, which is really interesting in the beginning of the Gospel of John, a different John, John was saying, "Look, there he is. There's the Lamb who takes away the sin of the world, and he's walking right there, guys. Just look at him." But now, after having been in prison for a little bit, he's starting to have some doubts, which could maybe be a good lesson for us now at this time. We've been essentially imprisoned in our homes, not able to do the things that we might normally do, and that can have an effect on the psyche. We'll talk about that in a couple of weeks. But here John's having trouble, and so he just wants Jesus to, "Jesus, can you tell me, are you really who I think you are?" Jesus doesn't tell him. He doesn't tell him anything outright like that. What he does is right that moment, and I imagine it like this. John's disciples come up and they say, "Hey, John sent us. We want to know if you're really the Christ." And so Jesus is kind of like, "Hold that thought." And he goes over here and he starts healing people, and people can see, and people who have not been able to walk since their childhood are able to walk. And you got withered hands that are being restored, and people being raised from the dead, and all sorts of crazy things. And so Jesus does this that very hour. And then he turns back to his disciples and goes, "Oh, I don't know. Tell them what you saw. And then you figure it out." The idea is Jesus proved himself by his actions, or he showed who he was by his fruit. He went and did the things that only God among men, only the Christ, the Messiah, the Savior of Israel, and all men could do. So you tell me, disciples of John, who do you think that I am? And Jesus often asks that question to many people that come to talk to him. So what we get to see here is that Jesus justifies himself, or we could say it this way, vindicates himself by his actions. Let's keep reading a little bit more. Let's go down to verses 28 and 29. In fact, actually, let's keep reading the whole section there. Verse 23 is really interesting because he says, "Blessed is he who does not take offense at me," which what this tells me here is that what Jesus is doing isn't like a straight, clear-cut deal as some people might like to think. There's going to be some people who don't want to make the appropriate answer to the question of, well, what do you see here? There's going to be some people who are going to be offended by this, so we'll kind of bury that for a little bit. But in verse 24, he says, "When the messengers of John had left, he began to speak to the crowds about John. He said, what did you go out into the wilderness to see? That is, when you went out to find John beyond the Jordan, out in the wild place, and to go see this wild man, what did you go out there for?" He says, "A reed shaken by the wind," like, oh, something that's afraid of things. Verse 25, "No, what did you go out to see? A man dressed in soft clothing? Well, those who are splendidly clothed and live in luxury are found in royal palaces. If you came out here to find that, you're in the wrong place." That is kind of a way to say, if you're looking for something that produces a certain kind of fruit, go look in the places where those crops grow. You didn't come out here to find kings and rich people. He says, as he continues, he says, "But what did you go out to see? A prophet? Yes. I say to you, and one who is more than a prophet. This is the one about whom it is written, 'Behold, I send my messenger ahead of you, who will prepare your way before you.' I say to you, among those born of women, there is not a one greater than John. Yet he who is least in the kingdom of God is greater than he." When all the people and the tax collectors heard this, they acknowledged God's justice, having been baptized by the baptism of John. But the Pharisees and the lawyers rejected God's purpose for themselves, not having been baptized by John. This is really interesting. I'd like to direct your attention to some grammar there in verse 29. It says that the people, the tax collectors, the sinners, all the people who would be dejected by mainline society, it says in my translation that they acknowledged God's justice. But more simply, you could say it this way. They justified God. Which is kind of an interesting thing to say. Is like, does God need anybody's justification? Well, he wants yours. In other words, he wants you to justify God, to say, God is the just one. God is right all after all. And why would you do that? You do that because you see the fruit of God's work. And so God's own work in sending his son proves himself, justifies himself, vindicates himself. If God were ever on the defendant's seat in court, he's got all the proof he needs that he's the innocent one and that those who are accusing him are the false ones. And so it says here that all these people vindicated God. They justified God, but there's some that didn't. And we see the Pharisees there. It tells us straight out that they didn't glorify God or proclaim his justice, which isn't that a weird thing to do? Can you imagine everyone who Jesus is talking to right here, talking to himself and, you know, saying out loud, like, praise be to God, is that he's right, and he did this, and you're right, that's who John is, and talking to each other, can you believe this? This is what Malachi was saying, this is happening right in our lifetimes. And everybody's so excited, and then there's the Pharisees over there who are like, no. And while everybody's saying, praise be to God, they're silent. And it says here, because they rejected God's purpose for themselves. And they showed that by their works. They didn't want anything to do with John. They didn't want to be baptized by him. They didn't want to listen to his teaching. They didn't want anything to do with them who would come after him. So this is interesting. We are justified or vindicated by our works. God is. Jesus was. We are too. So even though John had some doubts, Jesus proved himself and helped the doubt of the others. And then we get to see down here all the way from verse 31 and on where Jason had read for us. He says, what am I going to compare people in this generation to? He says, what are they like? Well, they're like children. So imagine this for me. It's like children who are playing around in the street, right? Your parents go to the grocery store or the marketplace, and you say, hey, kids, you know, do whatever. Just don't take anything and don't break anything. You know, if you break it, you buy it. My parents always told me, keep your hands in your pockets, they told me. And then they go to buy what they need to buy. So the kids are running around, they're playing, they're having a good time. And there's all sorts of games that kids have played for time immemorial. You don't have to teach them these games. They just come up with these things. And so for generations, you know, cops and robbers has been a big game among kids. I don't think any parent, my parents didn't teach me how to play that. You just come up with it. And so the kids are playing the kids' games. The kids always play. And one of those games is that some of the kids pretend to play the flute. And so they go out and they're playing music. And this is just life, right, is that you go to places where people play music. And when you play music, you dance. And so these kids are going around, they're playing music, but there's some other kids who say, no, I don't like this kind of music. And you've heard those conversations before, right? No, I don't want to play that game, or I don't like those rules. Let's change the rules and things. So the kids don't want to listen to it. Okay, so the first kids go, okay, we won't play, you know, this nice happy tune or pretend or anything like that. We'll play a dirge. We'll play a funeral. And, you know, death is a part of life, and kids would see funerals as well. And we talked about this before. I think the song Ring Around the Rosie isn't so, you know, rosy when you think about where it came from. And that's a kid's song. And kids come up with these things to express things in life. So they say, okay, let's play a game. Let's pretend we're having a funeral. So they play a dirge, a sad song, or pretend anyway. And the other kids go, nah, I don't want that either. And so the first kids go, well, what do you want? I play you a happy song, you don't dance. I play you a sad song, you don't cry. What do you want? Is anything going to make you happy? That's the idea that Jesus is trying to say here. He says, I'm going to compare this generation that he's speaking to right then to kids playing in the marketplace who do this sort of thing. He says, this is why. Because John the Baptist came eating no bread, drinking no wine. He's like an ascetic, like a monk, right? And you said, that guy has a demon. But they go down to verse 34, and it says, the Son of Man came eating and drinking, like being a normal person and going to talk to people. And then you accused him of stuff. You said, behold, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. Like, what's going to make you happy, folks, Jesus is saying. But then at the end, he brings it away from you know, the problem at hand and brings it right into the heart of people. And he says, yet wisdom is vindicated by her children. And that's really the point of our lesson here. Wisdom is proved by the things that it produces. So here, wisdom is like a mother who bears a child, and you know where that child comes from because it looks just like the mother. Or a plant bears some fruit, and you know that that's where it came from because that's the kind of plant that grows that sort of fruit. And so there's our option then. Wisdom is going to prove itself. And if I say, you know what, Jesus, I don't like Jesus' tune, Jesus will prove himself. And if I do like it, Jesus will prove himself, and I'll prove myself through that as well. I came across a quote the other day by C.S. Lewis in his book, The Problem of Pain. And the quote goes like this: if we will not learn to eat the only food that the universe grows, he's using a metaphor, he says, then we must starve eternally. And talking about fruit and veggies and things like that, I think it really hits home here is that some were convinced not to eat the only thing that God was going to produce, which is wisdom. They weren't interested in wisdom. And if I'm not interested in the only thing that the universe grows, if I'm not interested in the only hope of salvation that God provides, well, then I'm destined to starve for forever. And so what this teaches us, another thing here, is that wisdom is an acquired taste. It's not something that everybody likes all the time, but it's something that's going to prove itself to be the only true thing, which is wisdom. So let's go ahead and skip to another passage. If you want to, keep a marker here in Luke 7, because that will be our main idea from here on out. Wisdom is vindicated by her children, or is justified by her children. It's the same word that's mentioned earlier on when the people justified God. Same exact words, the same concept we're looking at. Let's go over to James chapter 3 and start in verse 13. James chapter 3 and verse 13. So Jesus told us, you know a plant by its fruit. That's essentially what he's saying. He says that all over the place. He's telling us especially wisdom is shown by its fruit. Wisdom is vindicated by its fruit. So a question we want to ask ourselves now is things, or are things like, am I listening to Jesus? In his proving of himself, am I taking that for everything that it's supposed to be? Here's another question we could ask. Am I a wise person? And that's really hard to try and figure out on your own. Because if you're just going to ask me, David, using David as a standard, would you judge David to be wise? And I'd say, yeah, I'm the wisest David that is David. Is that, you know, of myself, I am the wisest individual that I am. And so that's silly. In fact, Paul said, you can't compare yourself with yourself. That's silly. And so we need some sort of external source to vindicate or to help show us if we are wise. It, very much like how Jesus said, wisdom is vindicated by its children, by our children. So let's go ahead and start here in James chapter 3 and verse 13. James 3 and verse 13. He says, who is wise and understanding among you? So just think about that for a second. And like, who's going to raise their hand for that? And I think anybody here could be represented by a couple of ideas is that you say, okay, I'm wise. And then you say, well, am I really wise? And compared to what? And if I raise my hand right now, am I wise in my own eyes? Or is that a real wisdom? And so then I think, okay, well, maybe not. I'll think about that for a second. And then somebody says, you know what? I know I'm not wise. So I'm just not even going to try and go for that. I'm not going to raise my hand. And so usually, you know, we're not going to jump into this and say, oh, yeah, I'm a wise person, because we know there's some responsibility that comes with that. And if what Jesus said is true in Luke 7:35, then we've got to have something to show for it. If I raise my hand, I say, yes, I am wise and understanding among this group here, then the question comes, prove it, David. Prove that wisdom is vindicated by her children. What's the children that wisdom produces? What's the fruit that wisdom produces? James is going to get right into that. Let's read our next verse. He says, here in verse 13, let him show by his good behavior his deeds in the gentleness of wisdom. So if I say I'm wise, well, I got to show I'm wise. And one of the first things that comes from that is gentleness. Let's read the next verse. He says, but if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, do not be arrogant and so lie against the truth. In other words, don't raise your hand if this is going on in your life, because I'm not a wise person. So, okay, verse 15, he says, that wisdom, this wisdom, is not that which comes down from above, but that which is earthly, natural, demonic. Your translation might say sensual. Like, it's a wisdom that just gets all its answers based on the senses and stuff that you can see and what makes me feel good or what I think the way the world works from how I see things. We know the world's bigger than that. So he says, this wisdom is not that which is from above, it's from below. Verse 16, for where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there is disorder in every evil thing. So let's stop there for just a second. Here's how we can test if we've got the right crop growing in our lives. So fruit or veggies is the offspring. We need to be growing a crop, which Jesus came to plant. So is this crop actually working? Now, what we're doing right now at this point is we're doing what I was doing at my garden the other day, you know, getting down and looking at these little seedlings and flicking them and seeing, like, what are you? Where are you coming from? What are you going to be? And so we're looking at our own lives for that sort of thing. So here's what we're looking for, the characteristics of this earthly crop. First of all, this crop is bitterly jealous and selfishly ambitious. So when James says, who's wise and understanding among you? One, the implication is we ought to be wise. So there's no just like, I just get to sit and say, yeah, James, just go talk to somebody else. I'm not a wise person. I look at my life and I go, is there bitter jealousy? There's a good jealousy. God talks about how he's a jealous God and he's a good and loving God. And so there is a form of jealousy that must be good. Jealousy for a spouse to take care of them, to make sure that they're okay and that they're not taken away to other suitors or things like that. That's the jealousy that God displays. And so that's an okay thing. But then there's jealousy, which isn't good, which is I like what you're doing and I'd like to actually be in your spot and I'd take your position if I could and I'd undermine you if I could, so like I can have what you have. And so bitter jealousy becomes like envy. It's very similar to that. And he also says there's selfish ambition. So there's some of that as well, is that like, I like your position in life. I think that's pretty cool. So I want that and I'm going to take it from you. And I will be ambitious to the point that I'll undermine you for my own self gain. There's a lot of shapes that takes. That looks from, you know, like corporate sabotage or things like that. All the way to things like, I want to have the last say in a discussion because I think that makes me feel better or important. It goes all over the place. There's a huge spectrum of selfish ambition and bitter jealousy. So he says, he asks you, are you wise? Well, look at your life. Do these things exist? Here's another thing that you can see. If wisdom is vindicated by its children, other things are too. So this crop is bitterly jealous and it is selfishly ambitious, but it produces a fruit. It's an ugly, terrible fruit, but it looks pretty good most of the time. It produces disorder in every evil thing. Those are its children. And so look at your life. And when James says, are you a wise person? I have to look around and I go, well, is my life just like chaos? And is there just disorder? And is it like, does it seem like I'm the only sane person and all these crazy people? And you know how the proverb goes for that. If I'm the only person that thinks I'm sane and everyone else is crazy, well, it's the other way around. If I look around and I see everybody's fighting around me and everybody hates each other around me and just problems in my life and all my relationships are a problem, maybe the source of that, or at least a help to that crop, is me. And so I look at my life and my life proves what's going on in here. If I have wisdom or if I'm using the world's way of defining wisdom. So there's what that crop is and there's what it produces. But there's an alternative and a hope James has for us to implement in our lives. Let's read the next couple of verses. He says in verse 17, and we mentioned this in the last several weeks, if you don't have this as a memory verse, this is really a good one to get into your repertoire. It's a fantastic passage that is so pertinent to so many areas of life. James says here, but the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy. And the seed whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. So let's break that down the same way we did that previous one. There is a heavenly wisdom, and it is, or it looks like, here's what the plant looks like. It looks like purity and peaceableness and gentleness, all those things that we just read. That's what this crop looks like. I don't know if the right word here is, it's etymology, like what it behaves as, what it manifests itself as. It is this. And then what it does, or what it produces, or what vindicates it, or proves it to actually be wisdom, is that it produces fruit. And that fruit is righteousness. That's what it produces. So now we get a chance. James says, are you wise? Are you an understanding person? Well, look around your life. Is your life one that's full of peace and gentleness? Is it one that is full of, he even says, mercy, and it's unwavering? It's not hypocritical. That is, it's not one way. One day and another way, another day. Is this what your life looks like? If so, it will be shown and proven that there will be righteousness. And not only in your life, but the lives of people around you. And so that is to say that you will become, by the grace of God, a righteous person. But not only that, people that see wisdom, real wisdom, are going to be convinced that righteousness is true as well. And then, just like with Jesus earlier in Luke 7, they will justify God. They will glorify God because he is right and true. Look how he changed that person after all. He made them a wise person. So we got these two options now. And again, that truth that Jesus presented echoes throughout this passage. Wisdom is vindicated by her children. Or you could say wisdom is proved to be true by its crop, by its fruit. So what do our lives look like then? That's the question that James produces to us. I got another quote from C.S. Lewis, that same book, The Problem of Pain. The quote goes like this. If so, as he moves on from an earlier point about righteousness and the things that God does, he said, it would be indeed true that the joys of heaven are, for most of us, in our present condition, an acquired taste. And certain ways of life may render that taste impossible to acquisition. What he means by that is, for instance, I don't like beets. Beets are really gross, to me anyway. Hey, all right. But what I find interesting is if you go to like a buffet or a salad bar, there's still a little canister of beets there next to the salad. That is, somebody likes this somewhere in the world. And so there you go. So now we got other evidence. So there are people who like the taste of beets. I don't like the taste of beets. But what's interesting about that is, you know, I'm sure you could look up all sorts of things. People put them in their smoothies, right? Is that beets are good for you, and they're important for you. A lot of veggies are good for you. And so beets, to me, if I'm going to add that to my diet, is going to have to be an acquired taste. Like, if my doctor says, David, you're going to die unless you eat beets, well, it's like, well, I better figure out how to eat beets, I guess, and enjoy them and figure out how to like them. Because if I don't like them, I'm not going to eat them. So what C.S. Lewis, I think, stands out here in James and back to Jesus' point earlier on as well, is that if God provides salvation to all men, and let's say that some people are more predisposed to be, let's say, nicer people or friendlier people or different things like that, more predisposed to the gospel, does that leave the rest of us out in the cold? Because you know what? I just don't like the flavor of righteousness. I think here's the idea here, is that righteousness is an acquired taste. And wisdom is an expectation of all people, but that's not my natural resting state to be a wise person. And so we have to gain a taste for wisdom. The way that we can do this is by adopting what this crop looks like in our lives. In other words, like James says earlier on in the book, with meekness, receive the implanted word, like a seed, that I'll receive that seed and I'll let that crop start to grow in me. And boy, you know, it's not going to be fun all the time. It's not going to be easy all the time. If it were, everybody would be Christians and we wouldn't have this book and why even talk about these things. So we have to have an acquired taste and take this crop in. Back to that memory verse in verse 17, notice that list there. Wisdom is first pure. Above all things, it's pure and undefiled. Secondly, and following thereafter, it's peaceable. And now it's going to make friends with people, but it's going to do the right thing first. It goes on, it's going to be gentle. It's going to be reasonable or willing to yield, willing to not let its way have its way all the time. So on, it will be full of mercy, and it will have good fruits, and it won't change, it won't waver to the right hand or to the left, and it will be without hypocrisy. And so, if we want to be wise people, the first step starts here, is receiving the word and starting to put these things into practice. And it's not going to be something that you're going to enjoy right away. But it can be an acquired taste, and we can become wise people by God's standard sooner or later. So there's our crop. Wisdom is the crop. Well, if Jesus plants a crop in the world, showing God's wisdom to all people, and he shows that that can be produced in other people as well, that they can be a crop, some 60, some 30, some 100-fold, and as it goes out to produce its own crop, well, now we can start to ask, okay, well, if wisdom looks like peace and purity and all these different things, what does the fruit, which is righteousness, look like? What does that do in the world? Well, we can look at a couple of places. Let's go to some places in the Old Testament, in Isaiah 32. And I just want you to see a few connections here for a moment. Isaiah 32, and we'll just kind of skip around through that chapter. Isaiah 32, and let's start in verse 1. I want to tie together a few things that we've been talking about over the last weeks and months here in a passage like this. My Bible, it's kind of funny. My Bible has a little headline added by the formatters that says the glorious future. And from Isaiah's point, that's true. From our standpoint, this is the glorious present. It says here, looking ahead to the future, chapter 32, verse 1, behold, a king will reign righteously and princes will rule justly. Each will be like a refuge from the wind and a shelter from the storm, like streams of water in a dry country, like the shade of a huge rock in a parched land. Then the eyes of those who see will not be blinded, and the ears of those who hear will listen, and the mind of the hasty will discern truth, and the tongue of the stammerers will hasten to speak clearly. And no longer will the fool be called noble, or the rogue be spoken of as generous. That's how the world thinks wise people behave. It says, no, not that way anymore. He says, for the fool speaks nonsense, and his heart inclines toward wickedness, the practice of ungodliness, and to speak error against the Lord. And you know how you know he's a fool? Because his actions prove. You go down a few more verses here to verse 9. He says, rise up, you women who are at ease, and hear my word. Give ear to my word, you complacent daughters. For within a year and a few days you will be troubled, O complacent daughters, for the vintage is ended, and the fruit gathering will not come. But be troubled, you complacent daughters, strip, undress, and put sackcloth on your waist, beat your breasts for the present fields, or the pleasant fields, for the fruitful vine, for the land of my people in which thorns and briars will come up. So there's going to be some bad things for Israel here pretty soon, he's saying. But if you skip down a little bit further on, he says that it's going to be bad in verse 15, until the Spirit is poured out upon us from on high. And the wilderness becomes a fertile field, and the fertile field is considered a forest. Then justice will dwell in righteousness and in the wilderness, and righteousness will abide in the fertile field. And the work of righteousness will be peace, and the service of righteousness, quietness, and confidence forever. Then my people will live in a peaceful habitation, and in secure dwellings, and in undisturbed resting places. And it will be hail when the forest comes down, and the city will be utterly laid low. He says as he finishes, though, in verse 20, how blessed will you be, you who sow beside all waters, who let out freely the ox and the donkey. Blessed are you, you people, who go and plant the right crop, who go and plant this thing which will grow to such strength to be a forest where God the King reigns among his people who are princes. That's you. Now notice again here in verse 2, he says that even the princes will be like a refuge from the wind and a shelter from the storm. They will be like a crop which feeds the nations. And if we can connect that here to our passage in James, the way that we'll be able to feed the other people out here, the way that we'll be able to help produce righteousness in their lives is by being wise in our own. And our works will speak for themselves through the power and the grace of God. We could look at another place just momentarily. In fact, actually, no. If you're taking notes, you could write down Isaiah 60 and verse 20 on through chapter 61 and verse 3. But for time's sake, let's go ahead and go over to Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12. And we want to close up this lesson with this final idea here, drawing together a few things. Let's go over to Hebrews chapter 12. I'll start in verse 7 in just a second. So we want to ask a couple of questions. First of all, let's start with this initial assumption that we came into this lesson with. Wisdom is vindicated by her children, or in other words, wisdom is proved by the crop it produces. Now we ask some other questions. Well, what is wisdom? Wisdom is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, unwavering, without hypocrisy. That's what wisdom is. Wisdom produces a crop, which is righteousness, which not everybody likes to eat or be a part of, but for their own sake, we need to learn those things. They need to learn that acquired taste. So for our own lives then, let's ask that main question that James asked once more. Who is wise and understanding among you? Which of us then will also acquire the taste for wisdom so that we can help be a part of the healing and the restoration of the nations? In Hebrews chapter 12, if you're answering that question saying, I don't like the taste of that, to use our analogy, I'm not interested in wisdom. Wisdom doesn't serve my purposes right now. Maybe you say, I love God, but man, that's hard to be a wise person. Nobody's saying it's easy. It is hard. But if you say to yourself, you know what, I'm going to kind of rule myself out of this. I got no hope. I'll never like beets, you know, sort of that idea. There is still hope for you if you're willing. Remember back in Luke, Jesus said, or rather Luke told us, that the Pharisees had ruled themselves out of the promise of God because they were not interested, but it doesn't have to be that way forever. And I imagine that there might have been some people at that time, some of those Pharisees, who turned around and who decided that wisdom was true and that Jesus did prove himself. But if you're not sold yet on that idea, or you are sold but you find it very hard, I want to give you some tools to help you develop to become a wisdom so that if James were to show up here one day and say, who's wise and understanding among you? There could be people who could, in all good conscience and good sincerity, raise their hand and say, I am working on and I am a wise person. Here's how we can do this. Hebrews chapter 12, starting verse 7. Now, as we get ready to read this passage, I'd like to remind you that the Christian the Bible describes Christians as disciples of Christ most regularly. So you are a disciple if you are a Christian. Now, with that in mind, let's read this verse. He says, it is for discipline that you endure. God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? Illegitimate sons, that's the answer to that. So let's keep reading. Verse 8, he says, but if you are without discipline, of which all have become partakers, then, there it is, you are illegitimate children and not sons. Furthermore, we had earthly fathers to discipline us, and we respected them. Shall we not much more rather be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time, as seemed best for them, but he disciplines us for our own good, so that we may share his holiness. All discipline, for the moment, seems not to be joyful, but sorrowful. Yet for those who have been trained by it, afterwards, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness. That's wisdom. The crop that produces righteousness is wisdom. So here's how I read that passage as we close up our lesson. I read that passage as me sitting at the dinner table with God, and he has presented this perfectly cooked meal in front of me, and it includes some spiritual beets. And God, I'm not interested in beets. I don't like beets. And well, you're not going to get the dessert if you don't have any of your beets. And so I need to sit there, and God's going to say, you know what? You're going to sit here until you get it, or you're going to go home. You're going to go to bed without any dinner. And from a spiritual kind of an analogical standpoint, we can think about what sort of things those mean. So I have a choice here. I know I don't like beets. I know I'm not good at wisdom, but God is a loving father, and he wants to teach me how to be wise. He's going to show me that through his own son, through his own actions. He's going to show me that through his word, and I'll sit there, and hopefully God will be patient enough, long enough with me, so that I'll pick up the fork and I'll start eating. But we're not guaranteed at that time, and we do have a bedtime coming. God wants to train us to be wise people, not only for our own sake, for our own good, so that we be spiritually healthy, but for the sake of other people with which we'll interact, that we can have a hope in ourselves and also a hope for them through the cross of Jesus. So if we think about it this way, if Jesus is true when he said that wisdom is vindicated by its children, what then would vindicate us? If God is vindicated by his wisdom, wisdom is justified by her fruit, and wisdom's fruit is the peaceable fruit of righteousness. Is that righteousness in our own lives? Are we helping to produce that in ourselves and in others? And so the invitation then is for you and for anybody who is going to talk to you within a reasonable amount of time, that you can offer a good crop if we'll let God prove himself through our actions. How do we fit into this crop? Well, that's up to you. Would you like to enter into this, receive the word meekly implanted? Would you like to become a part of God's field that will feed the rest of the nation? If so, let us know. You can talk to us now, talk to us later, but don't let time go by. Think about these things seriously. If you have any need at all, let us know. We'll go ahead and stand and sing some more songs. Gordon will lead us in that.